This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Circling the Sun by Paula MacLean. Read for you by Catherine McEwen. I learned to watch, to put my trust in other hands than mine. And I learned to wonder. I learned what every dreaming child needs to know, that no horizon is so far that you cannot get above it or beyond it. These I learned at once, but most things came harder. Beryl Markham, West with the Night. We must leave our mark on life while we have it in our power. Karen Blixen. Prologue. 4 September, 1936. Abingdon, England. The Vega gull is peacock blue with silver wings, more splendid than any bird I've known, and somehow mine to fly. She's called the Messenger, and has been designed and built with great care and skill to do what should be impossible. Cross an ocean in one brave launch, 3,600 miles of black chop and nothingness, and to take me with her. It's dusk when I board her. Storms have hunched over the aerodrome for days, and what light there is now is stingy and wrung out. Rain beats on the gull's wings in timpani, and the wind gusts sideways, and yet I'm told it's the best weather I'm going to get all month. I'm less worried about weather than weight. The gull's been fashioned with a special undercarriage to bear the extra oil and petrol. Tanks have been fixed under the wings and to the cabin, where they form a close-fitting wall around my seat with petcocks I can reach with two fingers to switch over the tanks mid-flight. I've been instructed that I should let one run completely dry and close it off before opening the next to avoid an airlock. The engine might freeze for a few moments, but will start up again. I will have to rely on that. I will have to rely on a good many other things, too. All over the tarmac, puddles stretch out the size of small lakes, their surfaces whipped white. There are fierce, unremitting headwinds and low, brooding clouds. Some journalists and friends have gathered for my takeoff, but the mood is undeniably dark. Everyone who knows the real nature of what I'm about to do has tried to convince me not to. Not today. Not this year. The record will still be there when the weather turns more favorable. But I've come too far to turn back now. I stow my small basket of food, tuck the flask of brandy into the hip pocket of my flight suit, and wedge myself into the cockpit, snug as a skin. I have a watch on loan from Jim Mollison, the only pilot who's ever attempted this particular feat and lived. I have a chart that traces my route across the Atlantic, Abingdon to New York, every inch of icy water I'll pass over, but not the emptiness involved, or the loneliness, or the fear. Those things are as real as anything else, though, and I'll have to fly through them, straight through the sickening dips and air pockets, because you can't chart a course around anything you're afraid of. You can't run from any part of yourself, and it's better that you can't. Sometimes I've thought it's only our challenges that sharpen us, and change us too. A mile-long runway and 1,900 pounds of fuel. Black squadrons of clouds muscling in from every corner of the sky, and the light fading, minute by minute. There is no way I could do any of this and remain the same. I steady my position and lean into my stick, roaring past the onlookers with their cameras, and then the series of markers towards the single red flag that means the point of no return. I have a mile of runway and not an inch more. And she might not make it, of course. After all the planning and care and work and mustering of courage, there is the overwhelming possibility that the gull will stay fixed to the earth, more elephant than butterfly, and that I'll fail before I've even begun. but not before I give this moment everything I've got. After 500 feet of runway, her tail comes up, ponderously. I urge her faster, feeling the drag of gravity, the impossible weight of her, feeling more than seeing the red flag growing nearer. Then the rudder and elevator finally come to life, swinging her nose up, and she's left the earth, arrow straight. A butterfly after all. We climb the dimming sky and the rain over green and grey checkered Swindon. Ahead lies the Irish Sea, all that dark, dark water ready to grip and stop my heart. The smeary twinkling that is Cork. The hulking black of Labrador. The constant sobbing of the engine, doing the work it was built for. My nose bouncing, I drive hard through the wet spatter, thrusting into the climb and the shudder of pressing weather. The instincts for flying are in my hands, and the practical work of it too. And then there is the more mysterious and essential thing. How I meant to do this, and always have been, to stitch my name on the sky with this propeller, these lacquered linen wings, 36 hours in the dark. It was 2 years ago when the challenge first came up, in the noisy cedar-paneled bar of the White Rhino in Nyeri. There were tornadoes of pepper-flecked beef on my plate, blanched asparagus spears, each as narrow as my smallest finger, and deep-stained claret in all our glasses. Then a dare thrown out, like a last course, from J.C. Carberry. No one has managed the Atlantic solo from this side, England to America. Not man or woman. What do you say, Beryl? 2 years earlier, Mollison had fallen short in a similar water jump, and no one had done much more than imagine the aeroplane that could accomplish the distance. But J.C. had more money than he could ever spend, and the spark of a Magellan or a Peary. And there it was, the boundless ocean, thousands of miles of icy virgin air, a clear frontier, and no plane. Want to chance it? J.C.'s eyes were like agates. I watched them glitter, and thought of how his beautiful wife, Maya, should be there in white silk, with perfectly marcelled hair. But she had died years ago in a simple flying lesson near Nairobi, on a day with no wind or weather. She was the first air tragedy that hit close to us, but not the last. Many other dear ghosts were glinting from the past, winks of light playing along the rims of our wine glasses, reminding us of how reckless they'd been, and how magnificent. I didn't really need reminding. I hadn't forgotten those ghosts for a moment. And somehow, when I met J.C.'s gaze, I felt ready to pull them even closer. Yes, I said, and then said it again. It's not long at all before the last bits of light rinse from the ragged edge of the sky. And then there's only the rain and the smell of petrol. I'm flying at 2,000 feet above sea level, and will be for nearly 2 days. Dense clouds have swallowed the moon and stars. The dark so complete, I have no choice but to fly on instruments, blinking away fatigue, to peer at the dimly lit dials. I have no wireless, so the sound and force of my engine and the wind blowing back against my nose at 40 knots are soothing. The gurgle and sway of petrol in the tanks are soothing too, until 4 hours into my flight, when the engine begins to falter abruptly. It sputters and whistles, then gives out. Silence. The needle of my altimeter begins to spiral downwards with shocking speed. It puts me into a kind of trance, but my hands know what to do, even as my mind remains muffled and still. I only have to reach for the petcock and switch over the tank. The engine will start again. It will. I steady my hand and make my fingers find the silver toggle. When I do, it clicks reassuringly, but the engine doesn't budge. The gull keeps losing altitude, 1,100 feet, then 800, lower. The clouds around me part briefly, and I can see terrifying glints of water and foam. The waves reach up, and the fathomless sky pushes down. I flip the toggle again, trying not to shake or panic. I've prepared for everything as well as I can, but is anyone truly ready for death? Was Maya, when she saw the ground flying up to meet her? Was Dennis, that awful day over Voy? A bolt of lightning crackles near my left wing, bright as Christmas trimmings, electrifying the air. And suddenly I have the feeling that all of this has happened before. Perhaps many times over. Perhaps I've always been here, diving headlong towards myself. Below me, heartless water lashes, ready for me. But it's Kenya I'm thinking of. My Rift Valley, Longonot, and the jagged rim of Menengai. Lake Nakuru, with its shimmering pink flesh of flamingos. The high and low escarpments, Kikope and Molo, Njoro, and the Mutega Club's glittering lawn. It's there I seem to be going, though I know that's impossible. As if the propeller is slicing through years, turning me backwards and also endlessly forward, setting me free. Oh, I think, hurtling down through the dark, blind to everything else. I've somehow turned for home. Part 1. Chapter 1. Before Kenya was Kenya, when it was millions of years old and yet still somehow new, the name belonged only to our most magnificent mountain. You could see it from our farm in Njoro, in the British East African Protectorate, hard-edged at the far end of a stretching golden plain, its crown glazed with ice that never completely melted. Behind us, the Mau Forest was blue with strings of mist. Before us, the Rongai Valley sloped down and away, bordered on one side by the strange high Menengai crater, which the natives called the Mountain of God, and on the other by the distant Abadare Range, rounded blue-grey hills that went smoky and purple at dusk before dissolving into the night sky. When we first arrived, in 1904, the farm wasn't anything but 1,500 acres of untouched bush and 3 weather-beaten huts. "This?" my mother said, the air around her humming and shimmering as if it were alive. "You sold everything for this?"
"Other farmers are making a go of it in tougher places, Clara," my father said.
"You're not a farmer, Charles," she spat, before bursting into tears. He was a horseman, in fact. What he knew was steeplechasing and fox hunting and the tame lanes and hedgerows of Rutland. But he'd seen paper flyers hawking cheap imperial land, and an idea had latched onto him that wouldn't let go. We left Westfield House, where I was born, and travelled 7,000 miles, past Tunis and Tripoli and Suez, the waves like great grey mountains swallowing the sky. Then through Kilindini Harbour, in the port of Mombasa, which smelled of sharp spices and drying fish, and onto the snaking train bound for Nairobi, the windows boiling over with red dust. I stared at everything, completely thrilled in a way I hadn't remembered feeling before. Whatever this place was, it was like nothing and nowhere else. We settled in and worked to make our situation livable, pushing against the wildness, while the wildness pushed back with everything it had. Our land had no visible borders or fences, and our huts lacked proper doors. Silky, banded colobus monkeys climbed through the burlap sacking covering our windows. Plumbing was unheard of. When nature called, you walked out into the night with all the things it wanted to have at you, and hung your derriere over a long drop, whistling to keep your fear away. Lady and Lord Delamere were our nearest white neighbours, a 7-mile hack through the bush. Their titles didn't save them from sleeping in the typical mud and thatch rondavels. Lady D kept a loaded revolver under her pillow and advised my mother to do the same, but she wouldn't. She didn't want to shoot snakes or her dinner. She didn't want to drag water for miles to have anything like a decent bath, or to live without company for months at a time. There was no society. There was no way to keep her hands clean. Life was simply too hard. After 2 years, my mother booked a passage back to England. My older brother Dickie would go too, since he had always been frail and wouldn't weather Africa for very much longer. I had yet to turn 5 when they climbed aboard the twice-weekly train to Nairobi, with steamer trunks and handkerchiefs and travelling shoes. The white feather in my mother's helmet trembled as she kissed me, telling me I should keep my chin up. She knew I'd be fine, since I was such a big, strong girl. As a treat, she would send a box of licorice all sorts and pear drops from a shop in Piccadilly that I wouldn't have to share with a soul. I watched the train recede along the still black line of the track, not quite believing she would actually go. Even when the last shuddering car was swallowed up by distant yellow hills, and my father turned to me, ready to go back to the farm and his work, even then I thought the whole thing was a mistake, some terrible misunderstanding that would all get sorted at any moment. Mother and Dickie would disembark at the next station or turn around at Nairobi and be back the next day. When that didn't happen, I kept waiting all the same, listening for the far-off rumble of the train, one eye on the horizon, my heart on tiptoe. For months, there was no word from my mother, not even a dashed-off cable, and then the sweets arrived. The box was heavy and bore only my name, Beryl Clutterbuck, in my mother's curlicued script. Even the shape of her handwriting, those familiar dips and loops, instantly had me in tears. I knew what the gift meant, and I couldn't fool myself any more. Scooping the box into my arms, I made off to a hidden corner where, trembling, I ate up as many of the sugar-dusted things as I could stand before retching into a stable bucket. Later, unable to drink the tea my father had made, I finally dared to say what I feared most. "Mother and Dickie aren't coming back, are they?" He gave me a pained look.
"I don't know."
"Perhaps she's waiting for us to come to her." There was a long silence, and then he allowed that she might be.
"This is our home now," he said, "and I'm not ready to give up on it just yet. Are you?"
My father was offering a choice, but it wasn't a simple one. His question wasn't, "Will you stay here with me?" That decision had been made months before. What he wanted to know was if I could love this life as he did, if I could give my heart to this place, even if she never returned and I had no mother going forward, perhaps not ever. How could I begin to answer? All around us, half-empty cupboards reminded me of the things that used to be there, but weren't any longer. 4 china teacups with gold-painted rims, a card game, amber beads clicking together on a necklace my mother had loved. Her absence was still so loud and so heavy, I ached with it, feeling hollow and lost. I didn't know how to forget my mother any more than my father knew how he might comfort me. He pulled me, long-limbed and a little dirty, as I always seemed to be, onto his lap, and we sat like that quietly for a while. From the edge of the forest, a group of hyraxes echoed shrieks of alarm. One of our greyhounds cocked a sleek ear and then settled back into his comfortable sleep by the fire. Finally, my father sighed. He scooped me under my arms, grazed my drying tears with a quick kiss, and set me on my own 2 feet. Chapter 2. Miwanzo is the word in Swahili for beginnings. But sometimes everything has to end first, and the bottom drop out, and every light fizzle and die before a proper beginning can come along. My mother's going was like that for me, though I didn't realize it straight away. For a long time, I could only feel confused and hurt
and terribly sad. Were my parents still married? Did my mother love us or miss us? How could she have left me behind? I wasn't ready to go to my father with these questions. He wasn't all that soft as fathers go, and I didn't know how to share such private and wounded feelings. Then something happened. In and beyond the Mao forest on our land, several Kipsigis families lived in mud and wattle huts surrounded by high thorn bomas. Somehow they saw what I needed without my asking. One of the elders swept me up, murmuring a string of charmed words, and tying a cowrie shell ceremoniously to my waist. It swung on a leather thong and was meant to resemble the closed cowrie shell between my own legs and to ward off evil spirits. When a Kip girl was born, they did this. I was the white daughter of their white Bwana. But something unnatural had happened that needed setting to rights. No African mother would ever have thought to abandon a child. I was healthy, you see, not maimed or weak. So they stamped out that first start and gave me another, as Lakwit, meaning very little girl. I was thin and knock-kneed, with unruly white blonde hair, but my new name and place soon helped to toughen me. Running up and down our hill to the Kip village, my feet quickly turned to leather. Portions of our land that had frightened or intimidated me before became as familiar as the zebra skins that covered my bed. When the daylight bled away, I would climb under the skins and watch the houseboy pad soundlessly into my room on bare feet to light the hurricane lamp. Sometimes the sudden flare and hiss sent skinks in the hut walls flitting into hiding, the sound of them like sticks against straw. Then came the changing of the guard as the daylight insects, hornets and mason flies, tucked into mud nests in the rounded walls, and the crickets woke, sawing in a rhythm only they knew. I would wait an hour or more like this, watching shadows twist over the furniture in my room, all made of paraffin boxes and all the same until the shadows rounded and changed them. I listened until I couldn't hear my father's voice any more. And then I'd slip out of an open window into the inky dark to join my friend Kibi around a low spitting fire in his hut. Kibi's mother and the other women drank a murky tea made of bark and nettles and spun out their tales of how everything had come to be. I learned most of my Swahili there, more and more eager for stories. How the hyena had got his limp, and the chameleon his patience. How the wind and rain had once been men before they failed at some important task and were banished to the heavens. The women themselves were wizened and toothless, or supple as polished ebony, with long muscled limbs under pale shukas. I loved them and their tales, but I wanted more to join Kibi and the other Totos, who were becoming warriors, young Morani. The role of girls in the village was entirely domestic. I had a different position, a rare one, free from the traditional roles that governed Kibi's family set, and also my own. At least for the moment, the Kip elders allowed me to train with Kibi, to throw a spear and hunt warthogs, studying stealth, as Kibi did from Arab Maina, his father, who was head warrior in the village, and also my ideal of strength and fearlessness. I was taught to fashion a bow and take down wood pigeons and waxwings and vivid blue starlings, and to snap a rhino hide whip and wield a knotted wooden throwing club with deadly accuracy. I grew as tall as Kibi, and then taller, running just as swiftly through the tall gold grasses, our feet flowered with dust. Kibi and I often went out walking into the dark, past the freshly scythed grass that marked the edge of our farm, and the damp higher grasses that brushed wetness up to our hips, past the green hill and the edge of the forest, which took us in and in. There were leopards there at night, I'd seen my father bait them with a goat while we crouched on top of the water tank for safety, the goat beginning to quake when it smelled the cat, my father zeroing his rifle and hoping he didn't miss. There was danger everywhere, but we knew all the night sounds and their messages, cicadas and tree frogs, the fat, rat-like hyraxes, which were actually the distant relatives of elephants. Sometimes we heard the elephants themselves crashing through brush in the distance, though they dreaded the scent of horses and didn't come too near unless provoked. Snakes in holes vibrated. Snakes in trees could swing down and cut the air like rope, or make only the lowest rub of smooth belly against smooth-grained mahogany. For years there were these perfect nights with Kabi'i, and long, slow afternoons made for hunting or for riding, and somehow, with machetes and ropes and feet and human salt, the wilderness gave way to proper fields. My father planted maize and wheat, and they flourished. With the money he made, he found and bought 2 abandoned steam engines. Bolted down, they became the beating heart of our grist mill, and Green Hills the most vital artery in Njoro. Soon, if you stood on our hill and looked out past the terraced fields and head-high maize, you could see a line of flat oxen-drawn wagons bringing grain to our mill. The mill ran without stopping, and the number of our workers doubled and then tripled. Kikuyu, Kavirondo, Nandi, and Kipsigis men, and Dutchmen too, cracking their whips to drive the oxen. The iron sheds came down, and a stable went up, then several more, the newly built loose boxes filling with cut hay, and the finest thoroughbreds in Africa, my father told me, or anywhere in the world. I still thought about Mother and Dickie sometimes when I lay in bed before sleep, listening to the night noises push in from every direction, a constant, seething sound. They never sent letters, at least not to me, so trying to picture their life was a trial. Our old house had been sold. Wherever they had finally settled, the stars and trees would be very different from what we had in Njoro. The rain would be too, and the feel and the color of the sun in the afternoons. All the afternoons of all the months we were apart. Gradually it became harder to remember my mother's face, things she had said to me, days we had shared. But there were many days ahead of me. They spread out further than I could see or wish for, the way the plane did all the way to the broken bowl of Menengai, or to Kenya's hard blue peak. It was safer to keep looking forward, to move my mother to the far edge of my mind where she couldn't hurt me anymore, or to imagine, when I did think of her, that her going had been necessary. A kind of forging or honing, my first essential test, as luck weight. This was certain. I belonged on the farm and in the bush. I was part of the thorn trees and the high, jutting escarpment, the bruised-looking hills thick with vegetation, the deep folds between the hills, and the high, corn-like grasses. I had come alive here, as if I'd been given a second birth, and a truer one. This was my home, and though one day it would all trickle through my fingers like so much red dust, for as long as childhood lasted, it was a heaven fitted exactly to me. A place I knew by heart. The one place in the world I'd been made for. Chapter 3. The stable bell clanged, breaking open the stillness. The lazy roosters woke, and the dusty geese, the houseboys and grooms, gardeners and herdsmen. I had my own mud and daub hut, a little apart from my father's, which I shared with my ugly and loyal mixed-breed dog, Buller. He whined at the sound of the bell, stretching from his nest at the foot of my bed, and then looped his square head under my arm and against my side, so that I felt his cool nose and the wrinkled half-moons of scars on the top of his head. There was a thick, lumpy knot where his right ear had been before a leopard had crept into my hut and tried to drag him into the night. Bulla had ripped open the leopard's throat and limped home covered in their mingled blood, looking like a hero, but also nearly dead. My father and I nursed him back to health, and though he'd never been particularly handsome before, he was grizzled and half-deaf now. We loved him better for it, because the leopard hadn't begun to break his spirit. In the farmyard, in the cool morning air, Kibii was waiting for me. I was 11, and he a little younger, and we had both become part of the oiled machinery of the farm. There were other white children nearby who went to school in Nairobi, or sometimes back in England, but my father never mentioned that I might do anything like that. The stable was my classroom. Morning gallops started not long after dawn. I was there without fail, and so was Kibii. As I approached the stable now, he shot up into the air, as if his legs were coiled springs. I'd been practicing that sort of jump for years, and could manage to go as high as Kibii. But to have the edge in competition, I knew I should do as little as possible. Kibii would jump and jump, outdoing himself, and grow tired. Then I would take my turn and outshine him. "When I become a moran," Kibii said, "I'll drink bull's blood and curdled milk instead of nettles like a woman, and then I will have the speed of an antelope." "I could be a great warrior," I told him. Kibii had an open and handsome face, and his teeth flashed as he laughed, as if this were the funniest thing he'd ever heard. When we were very young, he'd been happy to let me join his world, maybe because he felt it was all play-acting. I was a girl, and a white one at that, after all. But more and more lately, I felt him becoming skeptical and disapproving of me, as if he were waiting for me to give up trying to compete with him and accept that our paths would soon be very different ones. I had no such intention. "If I had the right training, I could," I insisted. "I could do it in secret." "Where is the glory in that? No one would know your deeds belonged to you." "I would." He laughed again and turned towards the stable door. "Who will we gallop today?" "Daddy and I are off to Delamere's to look at a broodmare." "I will hunt," he replied. "Then we shall see who comes back with the better story." When Wee MacGregor and my father's hack, Barmy, were saddled and ready, we set off into the morning sun. For a time, Kibii's challenge clouded my thoughts, but then the distance and the day took over. Dust billowed around us, creeping under our loose tied handkerchiefs and into our noses and mouths. It was fine and silty, red as ochre or the brush-tailed fox, and it was always with us. So were the chiggers that were like flecks of red pepper clinging to everything and holding on. You couldn't think about the chiggers because you couldn't do anything about them. You couldn't think about the biting white ants that moved in menacing ribbons over the plains, or the vipers, or the sun, which sometimes pulsed so brightly it seemed to want to flatten you or eat you alive. You couldn't, because these things were part of the country itself and made it what it was. 3 miles on, we came to a small gully where the red mud had dried and cracked in a system of parched veins. A molded clay bridge stood at the center, looking pointless without water running on either side, and also like the backbone of some huge animal that had died there. We'd been relying on the water for our horses. Maybe there was water further along, or maybe not. To distract us both from the problem, my father began to talk about Delamere's broodmare. He hadn't seen her yet, but that didn't stop him from winding her neatly up into his hopes for our bloodstock. He was always thinking of the next foal and how it might change our lives, and because he was, I was too.
"She's Abyssinian, but Delamere says she's got speed and good sense."
Mostly my father was interested in thoroughbreds, but occasionally you could find a gem in more common places, and he knew this. "What's her colouring?" I wanted to know. That was always my first question.
"She's a pale gold palomino, with a blonde mane and tail. Coquette's her name,"
Coquette, I repeated, liking the sharp edges of the word without knowing what it meant. That sounds right.
Does it? He laughed. I suppose we'll see.
Lord Delamere was D to me, and to anyone who knew him well. He was one of the colony's first important settlers, and had an unswerving sense for which bit of land would be most fertile. He seemed to want to take over the entire continent and make it all work for him. No one was more ambitious than D, or more headstrong or blunt about the things he loved. Land, the Maasai people, freedom, money. He was driven to make whatever he touched or tried a success. When the risks were great and the chances were dim, well then, so much the better. He told good stories, his hands and shoulders moving so wildly that his untrimmed red hair slashed back and forth across his forehead. When he was a young man, he'd walked 2,000 miles through the Somali desert with one ill-tempered camel for company, and found himself here, in the highlands. He fell instantly in love with the place. When he went back to England to drum up the funds to settle here, he'd met and married Florence, the spirited daughter of the Earl of Enniskillen.
She had no idea I would drag her here by the hair one day, he liked to say.
As if you could drag me, Lady D often answered, her eyes playful. We both know it's typically the other way around. After our tired hacks finally got the water they'd earned, the Delameres walked us out to the small paddock where Coquette was at pasture with a few other brood mares and a handful of foals. She was the prettiest to look at by far, compact and flaxen, with a sloping neck and well-made chest. Her legs narrowed into shapely fetlocks and pastons. As we watched, she pitched her head and swung round to look at us straight on, as if she were daring us to find her less than perfect.
She's beautiful, I breathed.
Aye. And she knows it, Dee said cheerfully. He was thick-bodied and always seemed to be sweating, though he was generally cheerful about this, too.
He swatted at the salty trickle along his temple with a blue cotton handkerchief, while my father bent through the slats of the fence to get a closer look. I rarely saw a horse startle or run from my father, and Coquette was no exception. She seemed to sense immediately that he was in command of the situation, and of her, too, though she didn't belong to him yet. She shook her ears once and blew air at him out of her velvety nostrils, but held still as he examined her, running his hands along her crown and muzzle, and then more slowly fingering her withers and spine, looking for any bump or sway. Over her loin and rump, he slowed again, his fingers doing their work. He was like a blind man, feeling along each of her lovely back legs, the gaskins and stifle joints, hocks and cannons. I kept waiting for him to straighten, or for his face to cloud over. But the examination went silently on, and I grew more and more hopeful. By the time he'd finished and stood facing her, his hands grazing over her forelock, I could barely stand the suspense. If he couldn't love her now, after she'd passed all of his tests, it was going to break my heart.
"Why are you parting with her, then?"
he asked Dee, without taking his eyes off Coquette.
"Money, naturally," Dee said with a small snort.
"You know how he is," Lady Dee said. "The new obsession always chases out the old. Now he's on to wheat, and most of the horses will have to go."
"Please, please say yes," I thought, in a fierce running string.
"Wheat, is it now?"
my father asked, and then he turned away and strode back towards the fence, saying to Lady Dee,
"I don't suppose you have anything cool to drink?"
I wanted to fling myself at Coquette's knees, to grab a handful of her pale mane and swing up over her back and ride away into the hills on my own, or home with her, latching her up in a hidden stall and guarding her with my life. She already had my heart, and she'd won my father over too. I knew it, but he wasn't ever spontaneous. He kept his emotions locked away behind a wall, which made him a wonderful negotiator. He and Dee would be at this for the rest of the day now, sorting out the terms without stating anything directly, each carefully guarding what it would mean for him to win or lose. I found it all maddening, but there was nothing to be done but make our way to the house, where the men settled themselves at the table with rye whiskey and lemonade, and began to talk without talking, and bargain without bargaining. I threw myself down on the carpet in front of the hearth, and sulked. Though the Delameres had more land, and at least as many workers at Equator Ranch as we did at Green Hills, Dee hadn't made many improvements to their own living quarters. Two large mud rondavels with beaten earth flooring, rough windows, and burlap curtains for doors. Still, Lady Dee had filled the place with nice things that had been in her family for hundreds of years, she'd told me. A heavy mahogany four-poster bed with a richly embroidered quilt, pictures framed in gilt, a long mahogany table with 8 matching chairs, and a hand-bound atlas that I loved to pore over whenever I visited. That day I was too anxious to look at maps, and could only lie on the carpet and click my dusty heels together, biting my lip, and wishing the men would get on with it. Finally, Lady Dee came over and sat near me, settling her white cotton skirt out in front of her and leaning back on her hands. She wasn't ever fussy or prim, and I adored that about her. "I have some nice biscuits if you'd like." "I'm not hungry," I said. I was ravenous. "Your hair is wilder every time I see it." She gently nudged the plate of biscuits in my direction. "It's such a wonderful color, though. A little like Coquette's, actually." That got me.
"Do you think so?"
She nodded. "I don't suppose you'd let me brush it." I was too out of sorts to enjoy sitting still and having my hair fussed over, but I let her do it. She had a silver-handled brush with beautiful soft white bristles that I always liked to run my fingers over. There was nothing feminine in our house anymore. No silk or satin, or perfume or jewelry, or powder puffs. The brush was exotic. While Lady Dee worked, humming a little, I fell on the biscuits. Soon the plate was nothing but buttery crumbs.
"Where'd you get that fierce-looking scar?" she asked.
I looked down at the jagged worst of it, poking from beneath the frayed hem of my short trousers, a long rippled wound that went halfway up my thigh. It did look pretty rough.
"Wrestling totos."
"Totos or bush pigs?"
"I trounced one of the kit boys and threw him over my shoulder onto the ground. He was so embarrassed he waited for me in the forest and slashed out at me with his father's knife."
"What?" She made an alarmed noise. "I had to go after him, didn't I?" I couldn't keep the pride out of my voice. "He looks far worse than I do now." Lady Dee sighed into my hair. I knew she was concerned, but she didn't say anything else for the moment, and so I gave myself up to the tug of the brush and the way it rubbed against my scalp. It felt so good, I was half asleep, when the men finally stood and shook hands. I jumped to my feet, nearly landing in Lady Dee's lap.
"She's ours?" I asked, rushing at them.
"Clop bargains like a hyena," Dee said. "Just latches on and doesn't let go. He nearly stole that mare from under me."
As he laughed, my father laughed too, and clapped him on the shoulder.
"Doesn't Beryl look pretty?"
Lady Dee asked. She came up behind me and rested one hand on the top of my head. I wondered if I'd find a nest of titmice tangled up behind one of her ears. Reddening, my father cleared his throat.
"I'm not much of a nursemaid, I'm afraid." "Nor should you be," Dee barked in his defense. "The girl's fine. Just look at her, Florence. She's as strong as a mule."
"Ah, yes. We all of us want mules for daughters, don't we?"
The whole exchange was good-natured, and yet it gave me a strange topsy-turvy feeling. When we started for home again, an hour later, after the money and the details of Coquette's delivery were sorted, I could tell my father was unsettled too. We rode in silence, as the red sun inched lower and lower in the flat sky. In the distance, a dust devil churned like a dervish, whirling into a patch of flame trees and unhousing a fat band of vultures. One flew past, his shadow crawling over us so slowly, it made me shudder.
"I'll admit it all gets away from me sometimes,"
my father said when the vulture had gone. I could guess at what he meant from the way Lady D had blanched at my scar and general upkeep. I knew it all meant me, his daughter.
"I think we're doing all right," I said, and reached to pat Wee McGregor's neck. "I don't want anything to be different."
He said nothing as the sun continued its descent. This close to the equator, we had almost no twilight. Day turned to night in minutes, but they were lovely ones. Around us the yellow grasses stretched and moved like the sea, sometimes dipping into ant-bear burrows and pig-holes, or lifting toward the knuckled spires of termite mounds, but never truly ceasing. There was a powerful illusion that the bush didn't end, that we could ride for years like this, carried by the grasses and the sense of distance, on and on forever.
Chapter 4. When Coquette arrived, she was the darling of the farm. Since we didn't have any horses with her golden colouring, all the Totos wanted to be near her and to touch her. She seemed to glow and bring good luck, and for several months everything went smoothly as she settled in, and my father began to think and scheme over which horse should service her for the best possible result. Breeding is the most serious of matters for a horseman. Even before I could read, I knew that every thoroughbred could be traced back to three original Arabian and Oriental sires from the 17th and 18th centuries, paired with a handful of very specific English dams. The long line of genealogy was lovingly and painstakingly laid out in the General Stud Book. Over dinner, we would open the book and consult from it, along with the thick black ledger that kept a record of our own bloodstock, the Old and New Testaments of our Bible. After weeks of talking it through, it was decided that Referee would serve as Coquette when she came into season. He was a light chestnut Arab, and compactly built at 15 hands, with good hoofs, wide open shoulder angles, and perfectly straight legs. He had a stride so even it seemed to eat up the ground in front of him effortlessly. We talked about the new foal a lot, the one that would come 11 months from the date of successful breeding, with his sire's swiftness and his dam's shimmering coat and graceful movements. He didn't seem remotely imaginary to me. Our talking had already brought him to life. One long, airless afternoon, I was drumming up names for the foal and saying some out loud to Kabee as we sat under the wattle tree near the edge of the wide yard. Beyond the bluish ring of shade, the earth was like hammered metal, and wicked as metal too, or live cinders if you dared to walk on it. We'd spent the morning at gallops, and then helping oil dozens of bridles until our fingers cramped. Now we were drained, but also restless, needled by the heat. "What about Jupiter? Or Apollo?" I suggested.
"You should be Jackal. This is a better name for a colt."
"Jackals are so ordinary."
"Jackals are clever."
Before I could correct him, a tower of smoke came chuffing into view. It was the noisy train from Nairobi, a dozen crude carriages that bumped so hard along the track you expected one to fly off or smash to pieces. Kabee twisted to look out over the slope.
"Is your father expecting a horse?"
I didn't think my father was expecting anything, but we watched him come rushing out of the stable, smoothing his hair and tucking in the tails of his shirt. He squinted down the hill against the sun, and then quickly made his way to our new Ford wagon and cranked the moody engine. Kibi and I didn't ask if we could join him, just trotted over and began to climb into the back.
"Not this time," my father said, barely looking up from his task. "There won't be room for everyone."
"Everyone?" "I guess
coming then."
Without answering, he climbed behind the wheel and pulled away, pummeling us with clouds of rosy dust. Within the hour, we heard the buggy chugging back up the hill and caught glimpses of white. A dress, a hat with ribbons, and to-the-elbow gloves. This was a woman in the car, a beautiful one with a pile of glossy hair the color of raven feathers, and a fancy lace-trimmed parasol that didn't look as if it had seen a day in the bush.
"Beryl, this is Mrs. Orchardson," my father said, as they stepped out of the buggy.
Two large trunks towered behind in the boot. She wasn't here for tea.
"I'm so happy to finally meet you," Mrs. Orchardson said, quickly looking me up and down.
"Finally?" I think my mouth fell open and stayed like that for a good long minute. When we got inside the main house, Mrs. Orchardson looked around at everything with her hands resting lightly on her hips. Though my father had designed it simply, the place was solid, and a vast improvement from the hut it once was. But Mrs. Orchardson had never seen anything of that. She strode back and forth. There were cobwebs at all the windows, and the hearthstones were covered in layers of thick soot. The oilcloth on our table hadn't been changed in years, not since my mother left. The narrow charcoal cooler we stored butter and cream in smelled rancid, like muck at the bottom of a pond. We had grown used to it like everything else. The walls were hung with bits and bobs from hunting adventures, leopard pelts, lion skins, long corkscrewing kudu horns, an ostrich egg the size and heft of a human skull. There was nothing fine or very posh in sight, but we'd been all right without niceties.
"Mrs. Orchardson has agreed to be our housekeeper," my father explained, as she pinched off her gloves. "She'll live here in the main house. There's plenty of room."
"Oh," I said, feeling punched in the windpipe. There was a room that could be used for sleeping quarters, but it was filled with tack and paraffin and tins of food and any number of things we didn't want to see or deal with. The room meant we didn't really need a housekeeper. And where would guests stay now that this woman, who was not a guest, had come to change everything?
"Why don't you go out to the stables while we get settled here?" my father said, in a tone that left no room for wriggling.
"How nice, then," Mrs. Orchardson said. "I'll get the tea ready."
All the way across the yard, I fumed. The world was squeezing in on me, narrowing to the sudden fact of Mrs. Orchardson and what she might mean to do or be. When I returned, she had changed into a simple skirt and shirt waist and tied a clean white apron over the top. Her sleeves were rolled up to the elbow. A lock of her silky hair fell over her forehead as she refilled my father's cup, the kettle steaming in her hands. My father had settled into our one comfortable chair, his feet up on a low table. He was gazing at her familiarly. I blinked at them both. I hadn't been gone an hour, and she had already taken over the room. The kettle was hers. She'd scrubbed the oilcloth. The cobwebs were gone, and might have never existed at all. Nothing would need much coaxing or breaking in. Nothing seemed ready to resist her. "I was to call her Mrs. O," my father said. Over the coming days, she unpacked her steamer trunks and filled them again with things from the house. Dusty hunting spoils, odd trinkets, or bits of clothing my mother had left behind. It was all part of her plan to run a tight ship, two of her favorite words. She liked order and soap and the day sliced up into manageable portions. Mornings were for book learning.
"I have to be at Gallup's," I told her early on, feeling fully confident that my father would take my part.
"They'll make do without you for the time being, won't they?" she said matter-of-factly, while my father made a dry, throttled sound deep in his throat and quickly left the house. Within a week, she'd convinced my father that I needed to wear shoes. A few weeks more, and I'd been trussed up in an English frock and hair ribbons instead of a shuka, and told not to eat with my hands. I was not to kill snakes, or moles, or birds with my rungu, or to take all my meals with Kibii and his family. I was not to hunt warthog or leopard with Arap Meina, but have a proper education and learn the king's English.
"I've let you run too wild, and you know it," my father said when I went to him asking to be left alone. "It's all for your own good."
He had let me run, but it had been wonderful. These new restrictions amounted to a conventional life, and we'd never had anything of the sort. "Please," I heard myself begin to whine, but then stopped short. I had never been a wheedling or complaining child, and my father wasn't going to bend anyway. If I really could do something about Mrs. O, I would have to work it out on my own. I would show her I wasn't a bit of cobweb in the corner, something to be wiped or straightened, but a rival worth her notice. I would learn her ways and habits, and track her closely until I knew what she was and how to best her, and what precisely it would take to steal my good life back. Chapter 5. Coquette was nearing her foaling date. She'd grown rounder and more barrel-like, the new life inside her pushing out against her flesh, those long limbs already trying to stretch and find their way. Somehow the effort of creation had dulled her golden coat. She looked tired and listless, and rarely did more than nibble at the sheaves of lucerne I brought her. For me, the foal couldn't come soon enough. Thinking about him was how I got through hours of Latin in pinching shoes. One night, I was fast asleep in my hut, when I felt Bulla rouse beside me. The grooms had come awake in their bunks. My father was awake too. I recognized the timbre of his muffled voice and dressed quickly, thinking only of Coquette. She was 20 days early, which usually meant a weak or sickly foal, but it might not. My father would know what to do. Out in the yard, the glow from several hurricane lamps rinsed out through the cracks in the stable door. High overhead, ribbons of stars swirled like milk, and a sickle moon lay hard and bright on its side. The night insects seethed away in the forest and from everywhere, all around. But the stable was quiet. Much too quiet, I knew, before I even came close to Coquette's box, but I couldn't guess why until I saw my father stand up. He strode to meet me, stopping me in my tracks. "You'll not want to see this barrel. Go back to bed."
"What's happened?"
My throat closed around the words. "Stillborn," he said quietly. My heart fell, all my hopes silenced in an instant. Apollo wouldn't stand on tottering legs like a new giraffe. He wouldn't see the forest or the high escarpment, or race along the track with me bent over his shining neck. He wouldn't know green hills for even a day. But my father had never shielded me from the tough lessons of farm life. I forced back my tears and pushed ahead. In the shadow-filled box, Coquette had dropped into one corner. On the ground behind her, the hay was matted where two grooms knelt, trying somehow to tidy up. The tiny foal was there, slick in part of its bag, but also wasn't. Its eyes were gone, and most of the facial muscles, the flesh eaten away in a jagged blackness. Its belly yawned open, the entrails devoured, which could only mean the giant Siafu ants had come. They were black warriors with huge bodies, and they ate quickly and terribly, as one thing.
"She followed him so quietly no one heard her," my father said, coming to put an arm around my shoulder.
He might have been dead already. I don't know.
Poor Coquette,
I said, turning into his shirt and pushing my forehead against the bones of his chest. She's sound, he said. She'll be all right. But how could she be?